Hey, podcast listeners, it's Chris popping in here to let you know you can now find Think on Instagram. That's where I'll be sharing book recommendations, favorite moments from recent shows, and occasional behind-the-scenes looks at how Think gets made. So while you're listening to today's podcast, I hope you'll give us a follow. Just search for K-E-R-A Think. Okay, now on to today's show. Every year when August rolls around and parents start looking for deals on backpacks and new sneakers and all the school supplies on those lists they send home, seriously, 6 glue sticks in a single semester, teachers are getting ready too. They're decorating their classrooms, planning lessons, and thinking through strategies to keep every student engaged. The ones who speed through lessons, the ones who struggle, and the ones whose best subject seems to be distracting classmates. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Experience is a really helpful tool for teachers. And for those who might not have veteran instructors to lean on, my guest has created the next best thing. Philip Doan taught elementary school for 33 years, was Teacher of the Year in the state of California, and is a recipient of the Charles Schwab Distinguished Teacher Award. He retired from the classroom not long ago, but wasn't done sharing his knowledge. Now he's put his best lessons for fellow teachers into a book called The Art of Teaching Children, All I Learned from a Lifetime in the Classroom. Phil, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be on the show.
When you talk about teaching as an art form, I think a lot of people instinctively understand what that means. And yet in our culture, we often assume artists come into this world with some special gift that the rest of us just don't possess. Are great teachers born or can they be made?
I believe that teaching is an art. If you think about it, teachers and artists do the same things. Both call upon creativity, sensitivity, and passion, and both inspire. It's been said that one who works with their hands is a laborer, one who works with the hands and the head is a craftsperson, and one who works with the hands, head, and heart is an artist. Well, teachers use all three. And to your point, one of my favorite quotes about teaching is actually a John Steinbeck quote, where he says that he thinks that teaching might be the greatest of the arts because our medium is the human mind and spirit. In fact, I love that quote so much that I used it at the top of my book.
You have a great memory of so many of the students you've taught throughout the years, and it turns out sometimes the tough kids are the most special of all to you. Tell us the story of Travis.
Travis. Yes, I write about Travis in the book. Travis came to me when I was teaching fifth grade, and he had been expelled basically from another school for throwing a music stand at a teacher. And he came into my room, and I realized that Travis had gone through years from K through four of detentions and behavioral plans and notes home to the parents. And I knew I needed to treat Travis differently because Travis was not going to respond to that. And I knew that he didn't trust teachers. So I had to have a different approach for this young man, this 10-year-old. And so I did. I handled him very delicately. I did some of the things that teachers don't normally do. You know, instead of micromanaging him, I gave him his space. I kept him in the back of the room. I gave him little responsibilities that he had never had before. And I remember once we had a school play, and I let him be the narrator for the play, and he had never been given a part like that before. And I'll never forget taking him into the staff room, again, with little responsibilities. And I brought him into the staff room, and I said, hey, help me copy these papers. Because students like that, students who are challenging often are never given special tasks. And I'll never forget, he looked around the staff room, and he goes, oh, my goodness. You have a couch in here and a refrigerator. I mean, he was shocked. And I said, yeah, don't you know, we live here. And Travis did not misbehave in my classroom. He knew the rules and he knew my expectations. And yes, he got into some scuffles outside of the room, but he did not misbehave in my room. And I do believe that one of the reasons was because he really knew I cared for him. But let me tell you what really made the difference in my mind. I would leave Travis notes. And I write about this in the book. If you have a challenging student, and I know you have a broad teacher base of listeners, if you have a challenging student, try writing little notes to that child and just slipping them into the child's desk or on top of the desk so the child sees the note in the morning when they come to school. It can make a world of difference. I would watch Travis look at these notes out of the corner of my eye, but I would not make eye contact with this child because I believe that, you know, notes unacknowledged are even more powerful. So I'd see him slip these little notes after he read them into his desk. Well, let me fast forward to several years later. When Travis graduated from high school, I was invited to the graduation and I went to the graduation and I saw him. I hadn't seen him since he left elementary school. And, you know, he's a big strapping young man now. And I made a joke. I said, boy, if I need a bodyguard, you can be my bodyguard. And after the graduation ceremony, I was leaving and I was walking to my car and I hear a shout, Mr. Doan. And I turn around and it's Travis. And this young man ran up to me and he opened his wallet and he pulled out the note I'd given him in fifth grade.
Wow.
Yeah, he'd saved it.
Wow. I mean, you can't always know along the way that you're going to have that impact. I guess you just have to believe it's a possibility for every student.
Absolutely. You do your best. You try to make the classroom as engaging as possible. You try your best to make it a learning experience that the students will be eager to be a part of. And one of the keys to that, to having an impact, is having a relationship with children. And I write about this in the book. It's key. And when people ask me, you know, well, what's the big takeaway you want for teachers? The first thing I would say is to establish relationships with the children. I call it rapport in the book, the fourth R being rapport, reading, writing, arithmetic, and rapport. And children learn best if they feel cared for. And so it's very important from the get-go, from the start of school, that you work on establishing rapport with children. And let me tell you how to do this, or how I would do this. One way is to express genuine interest in the children. Be very interested in their lives. Ask questions like this. How was your piano recital yesterday? Or how was that soccer game? Or how did your ballet lesson go? Children respond to that. But one of the best ways, if you want to establish immediate rapport, and this sounds kind of silly, but it really is true, is ask children about their pets.
Oh.
Yes, children love to talk about their animals. And actually, every teacher knows that when you ask a child about their pets, you know, if you're sitting on the reading rug and you ask about a pet, everybody will start talking about their pets at the same time. It always happens. But children will love you for it. Ask about their pets. Another way to establish rapport with children, quick rapport, is to share your personal stories. I believe that stories are bridges from one mind to another. I'm a big believer in that. So when teachers open up and share their personal stories, especially stories about when they were children, around the school children that you're teaching, children respond so beautifully and they will never forget them. So I would always share my stories. I'm going to tell you something really fun. I used to tell my kids when I was teaching a story in December about when my two brothers and I would sneak downstairs on Christmas Eve and with flashlights and look at all the presents under the tree while my grandma was snoring on the couch. Okay, just a silly story at that time of year. Okay, about 15 years ago, I was in the bank and I ran into a former student of mine named Christopher, and I had had him as a student at least 15 years before, maybe more. And we got to talking, and as we were talking, Christopher repeated that story back to me. I was shocked, but I learned something. Our stories are powerful, very powerful. So two ways to connect with children: tell your stories and express an interest in their lives.
You share in this book a great pitch for an HGTV show, which is a classroom makeover show. What did you learn about the essentials of classroom design over the years?
Well, you're right. I do make that pitch for an HGTV show, and it's a bit silly in the book. But classroom design is very important. And I like to think of the classroom as a home. And you know, your book section is your library, and your sink area with your pie tins and your cottage cheese containers is your kitchen, and your desk area and file cabinet is your office. But I also believe in having a family room in the home. And that is an area where you can get an old couch from Salvation Army and a coffee table. You don't have to go buy new, and set up a couch and a table and some lamps. I learned once very early on that lamps can be very calming and can add a beautiful tone to a classroom. So I'm a big proponent of lamps in the classroom. Turn off the dang fluorescent lights. Honestly, buy some lamps. In fact, I have a funny story about that. When I first learned this and bought some lamps at Goodwill or something and was putting them around the room, one of my kids asked me, third grader, you know, what are you doing? And I explained, well, you know, these lamps are supposed to be calming and they're not like those fluorescent lamps, lights that are way up high. And so a little while later, his name was Kane. And a little while later, Kane stood up and walked over to the table with the lamp. And I said, Kane, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm feeling hyper. I need to calm down.
Phil, it is remarkable how young kids are when they start to notice who in the class draws the best and who reads the best and who does subtraction the best and who struggles with those things. How did you communicate to your students that there are lots of different ways to be smart?
Well, it is a lesson that I start every year out, and that is that there are different ways to be smart. Now, I start the lesson out, or I would start the lesson out by asking children, what do they think smart means? And kids will immediately tell you they think that being smart is good with numbers or you can read really well. That's it. And then I start to explain that there are different ways to be smart. Now, I would teach third, fourth, and fifth mainly. But when I would teach this lesson to third and fourth graders, that was a completely new and novel idea. They hadn't heard this before. And so then I would start asking questions like, well, how many of you like to draw and paint? And hands would go up. And I would say, well, you know, you might be what we call visually smart. And then I would say later in the conversation, we'd write this on the board, how many of you like to jump and run? And boy, you get lots of hands then. And I would explain that you are what we would call kinesthetically smart. And this conversation was a whole lesson. And I would point out the different ways to be smart. And you could just see on the kids' faces this relief because, it, you know, when they're 9 years old, this is the first time they're hearing this. And I'll be honest, and I'm sure your teachers will agree who are listening, many children don't feel smart. Many children who are, especially those kinesthetic learners, those kids are who are fabulous at, you know, doing a layup or running or, you know, even playing jump rope. Many children don't feel smart. So when you point out to them that there are different ways to be smart, it's a whole new concept for them. And you can see the relief on their faces. And I'm very careful when I give this lesson. Even when I write the words on the board, I will not write these words in a list, like going down the board. I'll write them side by side to show that they are equal. And so then after we've gone through the different ways of being smart, I will ask children to circle. I'll give them a piece of paper with the different ways of being smart, like visually smart and physically smart and good with numbers and good with words and so forth. And then I'll have them circle what they think, how they think they are smart. And it's very interesting. I've done this lesson for over 30 years. Kids are honest. You would think that most kids would just circle all of them because that's fun to do. No. They take it very seriously. Even at the age of 9, children know their strengths and their weaknesses. So then what I would do is, so we would tally this on the board to show that everybody is different. And then I would give the same sheet of paper for them to take home to their parents to fill it out as well. And they'd come back the next morning and share what their parents said about what kind of smart they are. And it was a very good activity, and I highly suggest it for anybody, first grade through fifth grade, because children need to know this up front, that there are many ways to be smart. There is not just one way to be smart, and it really makes them sort of relax when they hear this. It's a great way to start the year.
So I know teachers are always delighted when parents are in a position to help pick up supplies that the class might need, so it's not all coming out of your pocket. Lots of parents also like to provide treats on teacher appreciation days. Tell us about the hands-down most appreciated thing we can do for our kids' hardworking teachers.
Let me give you one that makes the biggest impact. If you are pleased with your child's teacher, or you're happy with something that's coming home, like a project that the child's working on, let your teacher know about it, either verbally when you're dropping the child off at school or with a note. Now, when I say a note, you can email the note, of course, but if you want to make the greatest impact, send a handwritten note. People don't send handwritten notes anymore, so it really makes a terrific impact. Let me tell you a story. I was speaking with a friend of mine years ago who had a second grader, and this woman just loved her son's second grade teacher. She was raving about her and going on and on. And I stopped her and I said, "Have you told her?" And she stopped and she said, "I'm embarrassed to say, I haven't. I didn't even think about it." I said, "Listen, a lot of parents don't, but that's okay. Send her a handwritten note. Don't email it. Send her a handwritten note." And she said, "Okay, I will." A few days later, I ran into her and she said, "Oh my goodness, I did exactly what you said. I sent the handwritten note and the teacher wrote back that it made her day." So number one, you know, the coffee mugs are great and the bath sets are great. But if you really want to make an impact, send the handwritten note. And believe me, teachers save those. I saved everyone.
Something that you really accentuate in this book is the importance of modeling reading, and that includes reading aloud. This is something that a lot of parents do when their kids are really small, and then as soon as that child is able to read independently, I think the assumption is we ought to make them read rather than reading to them. You'd have a different perspective.
Yes, I do. And it's key that parents read to their children. In fact, You know, if you ask me what's one of the biggest takeaways of the book for parents, I would say read to your children as often as you can. Now, you brought up a very good point. A lot of times parents will stop reading when their children get to around third grade, when they start reading those beginning chapter books. And I say, read to them as long as they will let you. I have a friend who reads to her high school child. You know, he's a high schooler. The benefits of reading aloud are enormous. And I'll point out that one of those benefits is something that parents might not think about so much. Of course, when you're reading to children, you know you're improving their oral language and their reading. But what parents might not realize is that you're also teaching children to write. When children are hearing language, beautiful language and beautiful phrasing and beautiful dialogue from a book, then oftentimes they will imitate those patterns in their own writing. So another reason to read aloud to children is that you are not only improving the speaking and the reading, but you're improving the writing. You are greatly enhancing that learning advantage. So I say, read to them as long as they'll let you.
What does it take to be a good performer of stories we read out loud to children?
Oh, there are many, many suggestions for that, many tips. One is you have to make sure that you are using different voices for different characters. Children want this. You know, you cannot use the same voice for, let's pick Charlotte's Web, for example. You cannot pick the same voice for Charlotte as you do for Wilbur, as you do for Fern. You have to use different voices. And if you use the wrong voice, children will tell you you're using the wrong voice. Also, they always do. Also, when you're reading to children, this is a rule of reading for children. You have to show every child the picture. You cannot skip a picture. If a child thinks you've skipped showing them a picture, they will announce it to the class that you skipped. and then they will all be suspect. So you have to show the pictures as well. Also, I have another tip, and this is for both parents and teachers. It's common when reading to children to ask clarifying questions. Ask questions like, you know, what do you think about the author's purpose, or what do you think is going to happen next, or questions like that. And questions are good. I'm not putting down questions at all. But I believe in not interrupting the text too much with questions, because, you know, that author who wrote that book deserves to have, you know, a good listen and to not be interrupted. And it breaks the flow. But most importantly is this. When children are listening to a story being read to them, they are visualizing what they're reading in their heads. It's very important. And if you ask too many questions, it breaks that. It breaks the visualization that they're, the slideshow, basically, that they're creating in their own minds. So that's a practical tip that I would recommend.
I guess it could also be a buzzkill too, right? Or after the story's over, if you sit them down and have them write an essay about what they just heard?
Absolutely. In fact, I say that if you just read a picture book or a chapter book to children, do not send them back to their desks and say something like, okay, let's all write about the theme of the book or the author's purpose or anything like that. It absolutely kills it. And you have to be careful. You brought up earlier, you know, those students who are struggling in school. We have a lot of children who struggle in reading. And one of the reasons you're reading to them is to instill a love of reading. So you don't want to overly activity your reading material. So when you send them back, don't give them a bunch of activities.
Phil, why is food such a good tool for teaching early math skills?
Ah, edible math. Well, so in the book, I write about teaching math with things you can eat, treats. And it is something that many teachers do in the elementary school. It's highly engaging. But the main reason you do it is because it's tactile. When you teach math, you want to always start with the concrete before you move to the abstract. Now, your teachers who are listening will know this, but I'll share this for the parents in your audience. When you give kids two M&Ms, or say a bunch of M&Ms, those are tactile objects, concrete objects. So two M&Ms plus three M&Ms equals five M&Ms. But if you just ask a child, what's 2 + 3? 2 + 3 = 5. That's abstract. There's nothing for them to hook onto. And so when teaching math, you always try to start with the concrete. And the thing that lends itself so well to that are, you know, Skittles and M&Ms and Lucky Charms and things like that. So that's why classroom cupboards are full of that kind of thing, because it really is something to use for teaching math effectively.
And when they're ready for the next level, you employ something you call real math. How does that work?
Yes, real math is important, and I highly recommend it. So let me explain what real math is. Real math is when you use real menus or advertisements to teach children, or even ads from, say, Target or Toys R Us. And let me give you an example. You go into Target and you see that they have the paper ads right there in the front, and you grab a few, and then you bring them back to your classroom and you use those ads to go on pretend trips or pretend shopping trips with your children. And a great way to do that is right now for back to school. I would go get some ads from wherever. Target is a good example, or Toys R Us is a good one too. And then you make math problems, you create math problems using the actual prices and items in the advertisement. And you can use those math or write those math problems any way you like, and in accordance with what you're working on at that time during school. For example, if you're working on addition, you would include addition problems, or multiplication problems. But kids love it because it's real. You know, it's authentic teaching. And I would highly recommend it, using menus from local restaurants or advertisements.
I have to ask you, Phil, so I've always liked kids. I never wanted to be a teacher, but the summer after my freshman year in college, I was a summer camp counselor, and I enjoyed the experience, but I realized I didn't think I ever could be a teacher because, although I tried to hide it, I absolutely had favorites, and I absolutely had kids who really got on my nerves. Is this something career teachers struggle with or figure out a way to deal with?
Yes, teachers do learn to love all the kids and care for all the kids, certainly. But I can't deny that certain children just stay in your mind forever. They're kids and students that are forever branded in your memory banks. And let me tell you one. There was a student I had in my first year of teaching named Rebecca, and I'll tell you a little story about her. She was an absolute character, and I had her, you know, now over 35 years ago, but I still remember her like I just had her. So let me tell you a funny story about this child. I was giving a lesson. It was a reading lesson, and she was a third grader, and I had just put a list of difficult vocabulary words on the board that the children were going to encounter in the text. And I did not expect the children to know these words. They were pretty difficult. That's why I was reviewing them. So one of the words was desperate. And I turned to the third graders. I said, hey, does anybody know what this big word means? And Rebecca raised her hand and shook it wildly. And I'm like, oh my goodness, Rebecca, you know this big word? And she nodded. And I said, oh, wow, can you use it in a sentence? And this little 9-year-old girl sat on the end of her chair and announced, Cleopatra was so desperate for Mark Anthony that she ripped all of her clothes off. Of course, I was speechless. Good thing was that it went right over the other kids' heads. You know, they were just third graders. But that's the kind of student you never forget.
And the ones that are harder to immediately be fond of, what do you do about that?
Oh, there's kind of a rule in teaching. Your most challenging students are the ones you fall in love with the most. Mm. I don't know why it works out that way, but it just does. And maybe it's because you spend so much time with them. You spend so many hours thinking about how to connect with that child. I have a term for those students. The students you go to bed worrying about, I call pillow students, because teachers will go to bed worrying about certain kids. And the ones you worry about are those challenges. In my last year of teaching, I had a student who was a real firecracker. That's kind of the term we use in elementary. And boy, did he just push my buttons, and I had to pull out every teacher trick in the book to meet the needs of this child. But I'll tell you something about this. I learned something from this child. I was letting this child get under my skin. I'll admit it. I really was. I was letting him get to me. And I had to step back. I'll never forget it. I had to step back one evening and say, Phil, you know better. You need to change something here. So I did. I started to look for the positive in the child. I had let him get under my skin and stopped focusing on the positive. And so after that day, I made a conscious effort to focus on those positives, to ask more about the child, ask the child directly, you know, how are you doing today? Yes, he was still challenging. But as soon as I did this little paradigm shift, and things started to get better. Now, he wasn't perfect at all, but things did start to get better. We were on the right track. And, you know, one of the things I did is I just asked him about his pets more that I mentioned earlier. I would ask about his grandma, who he loved. I asked him to draw a picture and put it on the file cabinet of his dog. And these little things added up. I did what I said earlier. I gave him little, we call them divide and conquer tasks, where you'll send a child out next to the teacher next door to get paper clips, even though you don't need paper clips. Just little tasks to show that you trust the child. And these small things added up. And this child ended up being one of my absolute favorites. And at the end of the year, I'll never forget it. You know, he came in and gave me a big hug.
Philip Doane's book is called The Art of Teaching Children. Phil, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a terrific pleasure. Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at the handle KERA Think. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can find it for free where you get your podcast just by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.